Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on the 16th of July, these are our main stories. Should a former IS supporter stripped of her British citizenship get it back? A court's ruled she can come to the UK to fight her case. The Twitter accounts of celebrities, politicians and businesses have been hacked in a huge social media scam. And Donald Trump changes his campaign team with just 4 months until the November election. Also in this podcast,
we want to recognise behaviours that showed huge dedication with no reserves, even when people were putting their own lives at risk.
Spain counts the cost of COVID-19 so far and gives thanks. In the frenzied early days of the Islamic State group's self-proclaimed caliphate, hundreds of women from around the world joined fighters in Syria and Iraq. Among them was Shamina Begum, one of a group of British schoolgirls who went to Syria in 2014. As the militants suffered setbacks, she found herself living in a refugee camp. The British government stripped her of her citizenship, so she couldn't return to the UK. But a court in London has decided that she can now come back to try to regain her British nationality. Here she is speaking last year.
I will admit I was the one that made the choice. Even though I was only 15 years old, I could make my own decision back there. I do have the mentality to make my own decision, that I did leave on my own, knowing that it was a risk, but yeah, I will admit it's my fault right now. I just want forgiveness, really, from the UK. Like, everything I've been through, I didn't expect I would go through that, and, you know, losing my children the way I lost them. I don't want to lose this baby as well, and this is really not a place to raise children, this camp. Not maybe temporarily, but not permanently.
If the Islamic State hadn't fallen, if they hadn't been defeated, would you have stayed?
No, probably left.
Well, she can now leave. Speaking to the BBC from his home in Bangladesh, Shamima Begum's father, Muhammad Uddin, welcomed today's ruling.
I've just heard the news. How would you feel if she was your daughter? I certainly welcome the court ruling. Every father would welcome it. I hope she gets justice. I've not spoken to her for a long time. My wife and two other daughters are living in London. I welcome the court ruling, and I'm certainly delighted.
I asked our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders, whether the British government could send her back to the camp should she return to the UK.
It would put the British government in a very difficult legal position to send her back into a place which is acknowledged to be unsafe. That would go against international rules. I mean, there's no certainty that she will actually come back. First of all, the government has said it wants to apply for leave to appeal, so the decision itself could be overturned. And also, there's a moot point as to whether the government is under any legal obligation to finance her return to Britain. Normally, a British citizen in trouble would expect the assistance of the Foreign Commonwealth Office. But as a commission has ruled that she's not a British citizen and is in fact should be entitled to Bangladeshi citizenship because of her descent, there's no obligation at all for the government to help her. So will she actually come back?
It is a huge legal and moral dilemma, and one that's not unique to the British government.
No, absolutely. The United States especially has been putting a lot of pressure on governments around the world to bring home their fighters and the brides of the fighters who worked or fought for an Islamic State. Some countries have shown a greater willingness to do so, France especially. But it's very difficult to get hold of the numbers of how many have actually returned. But there are lots of moral arguments on both sides. Shamima Begum there, as I've said, does seem to have justified what she was doing in this Islamic State. But in her defence, lawyers would argue that she was groomed, as you heard from the earlier clip, and that she's not really had a chance to put her case. And indeed, the United States itself has had a fairly ambiguous relationship to its own people who have served with the Islamic State. There's a woman called Hoda Mutana who was born in New Jersey, raised in Alabama, but the courts there have decided that she is in fact a Yemeni citizen because her father was a Yemeni diplomat, and she made very vehement statements against the United States, even at one point advocating the bombing of military parades in the United States. So, of course, there's no appetite for bringing somebody back like that, even if they do have a very strong case, perhaps, to be brought back.
Mike Sanders. The Twitter accounts of A-list celebrities, politicians and businesses have been hacked in a huge scam in what's believed to be one of the largest social media breaches ever. The profiles of Barack Obama, Bill Gates and Kim Kardashian sent out tweets asking followers to send them cryptocurrency. Thousands of dollars worth of cryptocurrency were transferred before the messages were taken down. I spoke to our reporter Charlotte Gallagher, who's been following the story.
So the hackers targeted Twitter employees, and these were staff members who had access to internal systems. And once they'd hacked them, they had access to accounts, and particularly blue tick verified accounts. And these are high profile people, usually with thousands, sometimes millions of followers. So Joe Biden, Kim Kardashian, Elon Musk, hundreds of accounts were hacked. Now, then they put out a message telling followers that if they sent them $1,000 in cryptocurrency, they would send them back $2,000 in cryptocurrency. And it's believed they got around $100,000 before Twitter managed to take this down. Obviously, lots of people realised it was a scam, but some people did fall for it. Now, if I was to say to you, who's the most famous tweeter out there? Who do you think? Who comes to mind?
It's got to be Donald Trump, hasn't it?
Yes, and he wasn't hacked.
Strange.
There wasn't anything on his Twitter account. So it's whether they chose not to or whether because he's the president of the United States, there are different security protocols with his Twitter account. Now, Kevin Mitnick was one of the FBI's most wanted hackers at one point and is now a computer security consultant. And he can explain a little bit about how this might have been done.
We've seen this all the time with phishing attacks. It's possible a Twitter employee with administrative access was the victim of a phishing attack. It could have been a person at Twitter who received a phone call, a pretext call, somebody pretending to be somebody they're not, to get cooperation, or apparently one of the hackers said that they bribed a Twitter employee.
So Charlotte, what have Twitter had to say about all this?
Twitter have said significant steps have been taken to limit access to systems. And this was after the hack was detected. And for a while, people who had verified accounts, they couldn't access their accounts at all. Jack Dorsey, who founded Twitter, he said, "A tough day for us all. We feel terrible about what's happened. And we will share everything when we have a more complete understanding of what went on." Obviously, a huge internal investigation going on right now.
Absolutely. I mean, those words from the head of Twitter aren't going to perhaps allay people's fears. It's very embarrassing, isn't it?
It's an absolute nightmare for Twitter. It's not just damaged their internal systems and their security protocols. It's their reputation. And this hasn't come that long after two Twitter employees were charged with spying for Saudi Arabia and essentially getting into the accounts of people that were criticising the Saudi Arabian leaders. So it's not a good look. Lots of people already really nervous about social media and security. And if you've got people like Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Barack Obama, Boris Johnson suddenly saying, "Oh, I'm not sure about security," and then they come off Twitter. There's no indication that they will do at the moment. That could be very bad for the company indeed.
Charlotte Gallagher. Siberia is known as one of the coldest regions on Earth, but this year the vast Russian province is experiencing a record-breaking heat wave, with temperatures reaching 38 degrees Celsius. That's the warmest temperature ever recorded in the Arctic Circle, something scientists say is only possible due to human-induced climate change. Alan Kasuja spoke to Walt Meyer, a climate expert at the University of Colorado.
It's been very warm. We're experiencing basically over at least a good part of the Arctic, especially Siberia, the northern central Siberia region, basically a six-month heat wave. It's moderated a little bit the last couple weeks, but before that, we had record high temperatures, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in June. The ice in the ocean, the sea ice in the ocean has been melting very quickly there. And so it's just been a really warm winter, spring, and now into summer.
How does it compare to past winters as far as the temperatures are concerned?
Well, compared to recent years, it's still extreme, but we've seen a lot of very warm years over the last 10 to 15 years in the Arctic. So it's still high compared to those, but it's not kind of blow you away high. But compared to where it was in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, we're much, much warmer than we've been in the past.
What is driving the increase in temperatures, do you think?
So the overall increase, we're seeing an increasing trend of warming temperatures. You know, that's global warming, human-caused global warming. It affects the Arctic more. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the globe due to the loss of ice and snow and feedback mechanisms that kind of amplify that warming. So we've got this long-term warming trend that's fairly slow. It varies from year to year. But then you get these warm kind of heat waves, you know, just warm summers, warm springs that just are kind of natural variability. But we're doing it on top of this overall warming trend. So that's why this year is so extreme and record-breaking, because it's an extreme year, but on top of the human-caused global warming.
That was Walt Meyer. China is in an enviable position at the moment. Unlike most countries, its economy has already bounced back after being hit hard by the coronavirus at the start of the year, growing 3.2% in the second quarter from a year earlier. But for the country's most valuable publicly listed company, it's a different story. Shares in the firm that makes China's most famous brand of alcohol, Moutai, have fallen sharply after the government linked the spirit to corruption. I asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, what happened.
Just a few weeks ago, the company which makes Moutai became, as you mentioned there, China's richest stock market company, $250 billion. And it's been part of a stock market rally over the last few months in China. What the authorities appear to have done is to be got a little bit concerned about that stock market rally, particularly the value of this company which makes Moutai. So they've suggested in a state-run, influential state-run media organisation that reminding people really that Moutai is often related to the corruption. Now, why is this? It's because it's expensive. Business people often hand over a bottle, as they might say, a bottle of whiskey in other countries to officials in order to try and persuade them to grant them the thing that they're asking for. So essentially all is this media company did was remind people of this, but canny investors took this as a reference to the government's perhaps disquiet the cost of the company or the value of the company and have pulled funding from it. So it's dropped by 8% and led to the whole stock market in China as a whole dropping by 4% today.
Wow, loose words certainly to make the share price suffer. What is this drink, though? You've tried it. It's very popular, isn't it?
It is extremely popular. In fact, I think it's the world's most popular drink, but it's really relatively unknown outside of China. It's made of sorghum, a kind of grain. It's extremely fiery, really large alcohol volume, similar to whiskey. But unlike whiskey and other drinks, which are often sipped, people usually down this Moutai in one. I've been to a number of banquets where this has happened and there have been predictable results of drunkenness and perhaps a hangover the following day. So yes, it's a very popular drink in China. And lots of people, because of that, invested in it. Now they've pulled their money.
That was a very sober Michael Bristow. Lebanon, over the past few months, has appeared to be a state in freefall. The country has been almost ungovernable since last October, when huge crowds first took to the streets demanding the overthrow of the entire political class. The currency has collapsed and at least a third of the workforce is unemployed. The crisis has been further exacerbated by a major scandal triggered by a shipment of tainted fuel oil imported for electricity generation. This week, more than two dozen people, including senior officials, have been charged with various alleged crimes in connection with the discovery. Tim Huell reports.
So now we can find some of the parts of the internal part of the engine that were damaged because of the fuel.
Yahya Maroud runs the new engine plant at Zouk, Lebanon's largest power station on the Mediterranean coast, north of the capital Beirut. In July last year, he says, he had to halt electricity production for a time. in a country already suffering chronic power cuts because of problems with the machinery.
After we did the investigation, we found that the bad fuel caused all these damages.
When another suspect shipment of heavy fuel oil came in March, Malrood sent a sample to an international testing agency. They reported it was off specification, or to use another term, tainted, dangerously low quality.
We found out that the sediment is 42 times higher than the allowed parameter.
But mysteriously, when Lebanon's Ministry of Energy, ultimately in charge of the plant, tested the same cargo, they found it was within the terms of the contract. That discrepancy has now led, directly or indirectly, to criminal charges against more than two dozen people, following a legal complaint by campaigning lawyer Wadir Akul.
There is a lot of people who confessed. They are employees of the government. A lot of them, they are in prison right now.
Can you just tell me briefly what it is that they have confessed to?
They confess they have been bribed to change the results of the fuel.
That's his version. It's a complicated case involving various different charges, not just bribe-taking, but also forging documents, negligence and money laundering against various different people, not all of whom have confessed. Those who will now face trial include technicians at the Ministry of Energy, senior state officials and businessmen in the oil industry. The scandals provoked further rage among protesters such as this young man, who regularly take to the streets to express fury at Lebanon's political elite.
The fake fuel scandal is a perfect example of the corruption in this government.
After the scandal broke, the government's contract with the Algerian state oil company Sonatrach to supply heavy fuel oil was widely publicised for the first time since it was signed with a confidentiality clause back in 2005.
First of all, what surprised me was the specifications part, right?
Lori Haytayan, head of the Lebanon office of an international campaigning organisation, the Natural Resource Governance Institute. The original contract, she says, is unusually short for a commercial agreement of this scope.
There are provisions protecting the seller, but not the buyer. The tainted fuel issue is just the tip of the iceberg. Behind that, there is a whole issue of corruption and state capture that needs to be dealt with. There are big questions that need answers.
Amid the outrage, Sonatrach says it has no legal responsibility for the recent off-spec delivery. It denies that there were any previous defective ones because ownership of the cargo passed to the buyer, Lebanon, at the point of loading, where it was independently tested and found to be OK. The company denies any corruption or wrongdoing. It thinks its reputation has been unfairly tainted in a Lebanese internal drama.
Tim Huell with that report. Also in this podcast,
seating is staggered, the chairs are in pairs. The audience will have temperature checks and be expected to wear masks until the opera begins.
The Rome Opera prepares to return for the first time since the pandemic hit, with a few changes. More than 28,000 people have been killed by the coronavirus in Spain. And on Friday morning, an emotional state memorial ceremony was held in Madrid. As it began, an orchestra played the national anthem. The royal family and political leaders, all wearing face masks, gathered outside the royal palace, accompanied by senior EU and World Health Organization figures. King Felipe said those who'd lost loved ones were not alone in their sorrow.
This crisis has put us to the test as a country, as a society, but it has also allowed us to see the principles and values that characterise thousands of citizens who have put so much effort and work into the general good. We want to recognise behaviours that showed huge dedication to others, with no reserves, even when people were putting their own lives at risk. They are role models. They have made us emotional and they make us proud of them all.
Spain, though, knows it's just at the end of the beginning of the pandemic. Coronavirus still has a hold in many parts of the country. There are more than 100 outbreaks. One in the city of Lerida has led to hundreds of thousands of people being confined to their homes. So this was not a day to claim victory over the virus, but something we may well see other countries do in the months to come. A chance to reflect on the losses and sacrifices made, as I've been hearing from our correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgecoe.
We heard from the brother of someone who was killed by the virus, who gave a very moving speech about not just how the virus had impacted him by taking his brother, but in general how it had affected the country, the pain it had caused by killing more than 28,000 people across the country.
No lo olvidemos, una ejecutora fría, cruel y destructora.
And how difficult that was for Spain to manage. And also he talked about the importance of responding to that pain with compassion and how that was what made us more human. So that was one of the voices that we heard in today's ceremony.
And talk us through the tone. There was no sense of triumphalism. Obviously, the pandemic is still going on in Spain, as it is in most other parts of the world. The tone was interesting, a very sombre tone, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a very sombre tone. This ceremony, it was not religious. There were a lot of high-profile public personalities. For example, the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, was there. The President of the European Council, Charles Michel. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. So there were a lot of high-profile people there, but the focus seemed to be very much on the ordinary people who'd been affected by this. You know, the 28,000 ordinary Spanish people who'd been killed by the virus. And also the focus was on the healthcare workers and others who'd been in the front line when it came to managing this crisis. We heard from a nurse from Catalonia. She gave a speech talking about how much of a challenge this was for her and her colleagues and for the healthcare system in general. Really, it was an unprecedented challenge for the Spanish healthcare system. So that was very much the focus. And it was a very somber ceremony. We had a poem by the Mexican Nobel laureate Octavio Paz was read out as well. There was some music. The overall tone was very somber.
And the political atmosphere throughout the pandemic has been pretty febrile in Spain. The opposition very critical of how the government has handled this situation. But the fact that the king played a central part in today's ceremonies and it was outside the royal palace, that was important in terms of unification of the country, I imagine.
Yes, and the king did talk about unity at several times during his speech. You know, he talked about this as something which affected the whole of the country. And I think there may have been a message there to the country's politicians who have been very divided on this, as you say. You know, it's been an extremely polarising issue. Spanish politics was already polarised between left and right before this crisis hit. But as soon as it did, and as soon as the number of those being killed by the pandemic started to mount, the right-wing opposition started to criticise the left-wing government very harshly indeed, saying it had been ill-prepared, that there wasn't enough protective clothing, that there was incompetence. And it also even suggested that there has been some masking of the true extent of the numbers of those killed as well. So it has been at times a really vitriolic atmosphere. And I think the king today, part of his message, appeared to be trying to unify the country.
Guy Hedgecoe. Now, would you deliberately infect yourself with coronavirus to test experimental vaccines? That's what a number of Nobel Prize-winning scientists are asking people to do. They've written to the US National Institutes of Health saying the idea could save millions of lives. Here's our medical correspondent, Fergus Walsh.
There are now an astonishing 23 coronavirus vaccines in clinical trials around the world. The only way we'll know if any of them works is if enough volunteers are subsequently exposed to coronavirus in their daily lives and don't get infected. That could take well into next year, given that many studies are being conducted in countries where infection rates are falling. The organisation One Day Sooner argues this should not be left to chance. It wants healthy young volunteers to be deliberately given coronavirus after receiving the vaccine, arguing that the risk to their health will be low, but the potential benefits to society enormous. As well as Nobel laureates, an open letter supporting so-called challenge trials has been signed by the director of the Jenner Institute at Oxford University, which has one of the leading experimental coronavirus vaccines.
Fergus Walsh. There are less than 4 months until the US presidential election. Normally, candidates would be fine-tuning their electoral strategy and sharpening key messages. But Donald Trump has just replaced his campaign manager, Brad Parscale, who boasted that more than a million people planned to attend a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, last month, only for the turnout to be unexpectedly low. My colleague Janat Jalil asked our correspondent David Willis about Mr. Parscale's replacement.
Bill Stepien is the man who's replacing Brad Parscale. He was Brad Parscale's deputy. He would now be taking over from him in large part because of that fateful rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma last month, a rally that was intended to reboot President Trump's re-election campaign. It failed dismally. The campaign claimed nearly a million people had requested tickets for the event, but were subsequently forced to concede that just over 6,000 people had actually attended. So Brad Parscale is demoted, but he remains on the team. And with 4 months to go to the election, this is late in the day to be shaking things up.
Late in the day, Mr. Trump is really trailing Joe Biden, sometimes by double digits. So how will this change help him to revive his flagging campaign?
Well, that really is the million-dollar question. Mr. Trump's handling of the coronavirus has weakened his position in the polls, no doubt about that. He's currently trailing his Democratic rival Joe Biden. We saw two new opinion polls that may just have hastened Brad Parscale's departure. Both of them show Donald Trump trailing Mr. Biden by a considerable margin, 15 points in the case of one poll, 11 points in the case of the other. And those polls point to growing disapproval of President Trump's job performance, particularly his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, as I mentioned. But they also show signs of weakening support for his handling of the economy. That's something that's long been seen as Donald Trump's strongest suit, if you like.
David Willis. Just how should the EU's economy recover from the pandemic? And should rich countries make financial sacrifices for the greater good of the union? These are questions EU leaders are pondering at the moment. They're meeting to try to end a dispute over whether the union's recovery fund should issue grants or loans, which would be less costly for the taxpayer. Bethany Bell reports on what Austrians think.
The Welsh Riesling makes the most beautiful dry white wine.
Philly Opitz tends his vineyards in Burgenland in eastern Austria. A winemaker who also owns a guest house says he's lost half of his yearly income. He thinks it's important for Austria to help other EU countries, but he says they should be given loans, not grants.
Nobody's giving us money. You know, we're working so hard. We have our children, we have our next generation. Why shall we? There should be a plan. And if there's a plan, I think people will be agreeing, but there must be a plan that the people, they have to pay it back.
If there is a decision to give grants, what do you think the reaction will be here?
The reaction would not be positive. This would be against Europe. I'm a big fan about the euro, about Europe, because the free trading, the free borders, it's so helpful for developing good, positive business. So I hope people make a really clever, wise decision.
Es ist gemeinsam mit
Willi supports the tough position taken by Austria's Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, and his message about being careful with Austrian taxpayers' money is popular. But Paul Schmidt from the Austrian Society for European Politics believes there will be a deal.
They know there will be a compromise which will be also beneficial for them, because Austria is a small open economy whose welfare depends very much on its exports and on the single market. And if the single market doesn't work, if our neighbours are not doing well, we're not doing well.
Other Austrians say Mr. Kurz's rhetoric is too hardline and nationalist. At a market in Vienna, piled with fruit from Spain and Italy, I met Britta Poll, a translator.
I think it's a populist and egotistical and, frankly, quite stupid position, because Austria, while being a rich country, is dependent on its neighbours, on the EU, on the euro, and also on the whole world. So just making believe that we could stand alone and just close our borders and we'd be okay is just ridiculous.
During my next trip in Italy, I will go straight into the vineyard.
Back at the vineyard, Vili says he's preparing to go to Italy to train a winemaking business there. Many here realise help is needed throughout Europe. But when it comes to money, the devil is always in the details.
Bethany Bell. All over the world, music theatres have closed down due to the coronavirus. But on Friday night in Italy, the Rome Opera will hold its first performance since lockdown was introduced 4 months ago. This production of Verdi's Rigoletto will be staged in the modern setting of a criminal underworld on an expanded stage to allow for social distancing. Quentin Somerville reports.
The staging of Rome Opera's Rigoletto is modern, set in a criminal underworld with cars, a caravan and a video screen. And the innovations continue offstage too. This is a COVID adaptation of Verdi's masterpiece. Seating is staggered, the chairs are in pairs. The audience will have temperature checks and be expected to wear masks until the opera begins. Performers will also keep their distance on an expanded stage. It's being held in the Circus Maximus, where chariots once raced and religious festivals were celebrated. This will be a grand celebration too, with Italy's president and Rome's mayor in attendance. A cautious and careful spectacle for a country which is still emerging from one of the severest coronavirus outbreaks.
Quentin Somerville reporting there from Rome. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address, as usual, is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.